The Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service is...
What's been happening?
Who's involved?
Why it matters?
What might happen next?
I think what the Global News Podcast does really well is pick stories about places that surprise people.
That try to overturn expectations.
News stories that perhaps you won't have heard anywhere else and the things to look out for in the future.
The Global News Podcast helps you catch up with our restless world in your own time.
Search for it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is On the Podium from the BBC World Service with the BBC's athletics commentator Ed Harry, Paralympian Scout Bassett, and me, Eliza Skinner. This is the show that needs no introduction, but they've already paid me, so here goes. On the Podium tells the inspirational stories of Olympics and Paralympics, past and present. Okay, there, I did it. Let's do the show.
You know, we don't learn from each other's careers often enough in these chats. We have three related and yet different careers here. Comedian, athlete, and whatever Ed does.
Stuff. Yeah.
Sports talking. Mm. Yeah. What's the best kept secret from your job?
It's not so much a secret that I keep, but people have the assumption, maybe because the BBC has been around since broadcasting has been around. They tend to think you almost have the equivalent of butlers to do everything for you. And it's when we're in a studio, there is a studio engineer, studio director, and their role is to open and close all the faders and make everything sound good. And all the rest of the time, we push all the buttons ourselves. We carry our own kit. I'm speaking to you now on my laptop. So if I mess this up, it's me that's messed it up. I don't have someone called Perkins away in the wings to come and fix it in a BBC way. But people wonderfully still think that the BBC is this sort of cast of thousands. And so I go, no, it's just me.
What about you, Scout?
When people ask me what I do for training, there's a couple of things I most commonly hear. Oh, you just run in circles? Like, that's what you do? I'm like, well, not quite. But then they also think, like, okay, if you run 100 meters, so you must only train for like a half an hour, right? It's like a race so short. You tell them you spend, you know, 6-7 hours a day, and they're just like shocked, right? That something so short could take so much time. But I think being an athlete, of course, it's all the regular things that people think. It's like so glamorous, and you must meet lots of famous people, and you're, you know, flying first class or on a PJ everywhere, and you're getting wined and dined. And it's like, well, not quite. So that's just the kind of fun, you know, the funny stuff that you hear.
Yeah. I definitely can relate to the length of time thing as a comic. You know, we're, especially when you're first starting out, you're dealing like 5 minute sets, 10 minute sets, or even when you're headlining, you're doing 45 minutes. So people think, oh, you just work 45 minutes a day. It's like, well, no, I actually have to write all of that stuff and work on it and improve it. And there's a lot of other work there.
Or they think you're funny all the time. Like, she must be funny all the time.
That's what I think the best kept secret for comedy is that a lot of us are very shy and don't relish talking with strangers. Like, I think a lot of times when people meet a comic, they expect them to be like, that's right, I do comedy. Want to see some? And like a clown, or like they're going to juggle their jokes in front of you. When in fact, it's like, yeah, that's what I do. Okay. Thank you all for coming to my show. Please let me go hide in a hotel room now. You
know? Like, I have an off switch too.
Yeah. And especially when the actual job is kind of being social in a way, it's like doing that exact same job off stage. So it's exactly what you're tired of doing. That, and that we eat a lot of chicken fingers.
Mm. Like, because at comedy clubs?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Best get on with it. Ed, who is joining us on the podium?
Our guest today is an Olympic racewalking champion, but they didn't receive their gold medal at a ceremony that night at the London 2012 Games or even the next day. Instead, they were initially awarded silver and only upgraded several years later when the original winner was disqualified for doping, for being a drugs cheat. Our guest has spoken out time and again and remains a vocal advocate for clean sport. He's also a Commonwealth Games gold medalist, and he's one of Australia's greatest track and field athletes. Jared Tallant, welcome to On the Podium.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
We're so glad to have you here. And we have some photos from your life that we'll be using to sort of guide our discussion. Let's take a look at the first one now.
Jared, our show is called On the Podium, and this is you on the Mall at London 2012, where the podium has been set up. And actually, the three medalists, you're all standing on the middle step, on the gold medalist step, but you've got a silver around your neck. There's a Russian athlete wearing the gold medal. We've never had a guest on before who didn't get their gold medal at the time. So just take us back to that moment. Winning any medal is, I guess, supposed to be one of the greatest moments of your life, but what were you thinking when you finished the race in second place and at that moment when you've been given the medal on the podium?
Yeah, it was difficult. I'd actually done the best performance of my life, had done a huge personal best, performed probably above what I expected to on the day, and was really just internally very happy with my performance and the way I was able to race the race. But just had that lingering feeling of knowing that I was probably beaten by a cheat. The Russians during that time were probably one of the worst groups in the world for doping in any sport. All the Russian walkers were trained by the same coach, and they'd had probably around 30 athletes by that time under the one coach who'd been banned for doping. So we knew it was pretty much like a bit of a doping factory over there in Russia, and it was incredibly frustrating as a clean athlete knowing that you're going into the race and you might be in the best shape of your life and you had a good chance of placing well, but it was going to be extremely tough to beat the Russians. I managed to beat two of them that day. It was just fortunate that 4 years later, the Russian ended up being banned, and then I got to get the gold medal.
How did the story unfold for you being with these other athletes and realizing this is not right? There's doping going on.
A lot of the international athletes that I was good friends with that actually come out to Australia every year and train with us just because of our climate, weather. And I was training in Canberra at the Australian Institute of Sport, and we quite often have a big international training camp there, or would go to the mountains in New South Wales for training. So we had a big group that were always coming together. We had some British, Swedish, Canadian, some of the Mexicans would even come out. So it was quite a wide variety of athletes, and we all knew that we were training together. So we were all doing the right thing. No one was, we didn't have suspicions on any of us in the group. But clearly the Russians were, those athletes were not competing throughout the year. They'd only ever turn up at the major championships or race in Russia, which in itself is quite suspicious. And when they went to a major championship, they'd only ever arrive like the day or two before the competition, then they'd leave straight after. And in our mind, that was just clearly to avoid getting tested. We never really trusted what was happening in Russia with the testing that was going over there, and just that the coach had so many athletes banned. They were just doing things very suspiciously.
So far removed from sport when you said that they were coming in right before the competition and then leaving right after, I was like, oh, that definitely sounds like guilty behavior. That sounds like someone who doesn't want to make friends with the other athletes because they know they're doing something bad. Your explanation makes a lot more sense. It seems more relevant. Did you have support from other people in your sport or people around you, or was this were you kind of on your own trying to call this out?
Yeah, we had a good group of international athletes from all different countries who were very supportive of each other. We'd sort of banded together over the next few years and were being very vocal and trying to make our voices heard that it was unfair. It was unfair for all the clean athletes and what they were competing against. And primarily it started that our first aim was just to get the coach banned. He was just using his resources to dope all these athletes.
Sounds like that was part of his training regimen.
Yeah, yeah. And it was clearly obvious having about 30 athletes banned at the time. So,
oh my gosh.
I remember going to 2015 World Championships, the group of athletes that were trying to make our voices heard ended up creating T-shirts and came up with a hashtag on the T-shirt and said ban Chagan, because the coach's last name was Chagan. So we were wearing that at the World Championships trying to, you know, drum up support for that to happen.
I mean, the governing body eventually caught up. At the end of 2015, there'd been a change in the presidency at the top of what is now called World Athletics. It was called the IAAF then. And at the end of 2015, Russia was banned as a country for exactly what you're describing. they described it as, an independent inquiry described it as akin to state-sponsored doping. This was a system, a top-down system. But you wouldn't have known any of that in 2012. You wouldn't have known that 4 years later, that medal would eventually be coming your way. Did you just have to think to yourself, I still have to somehow enjoy this moment in London. I have to enjoy what I did, because maybe I'm the only one who's ever going to really pat me on the back for what I've just done.
On the day, I was still very proud of my achievement and just enjoyed it for what it was in the performance that I gave. And I had all my family there that had come over from Australia. They knew the performance I put in was probably the best performance that I'd ever done. So we were just celebrating the fact I was able to perform at my best and knew it was a clean result and something that I could be really proud of.
A Paralympic, an Olympic ceremony, podium moment only happens once. There's not a do-over. And in the time since that ceremony happened, you know, you were essentially robbed of that moment. And, you know, on that stage, in front of that audience, what are your thoughts or feelings about having that taken away from you? I mean, I know you've gotten your medal since, but certainly that moment, that glory, you know, you don't get that to do that over again. So how have you felt about that since?
Yeah, it's tough. It's pretty heartbreaking to find out that the athlete who did beat you is a cheat, ended up cheating his way to that success. And I didn't get to have my moment, my time to really celebrate it on the day. And that's something that, probably will never really sit that well with me as an athlete, because you put a lot of effort, the amount of hours, I mean, you're training up to 200 kilometers a week. So that's, probably 15 hours on the road each week. And I guess for me, I just try to think about what I did, and I did it the right way. So I can just be proud of that. And the main thing going forward in the future is that athletes don't have to experience what I did.
So 4 years later, Jared, we're looking at an image now. You're standing on an Olympic podium in your home state of Victoria. And it looks like outside of a major civic building, there's lights there, there's Olympic banners, and gold medal presentation, Jared Talent is what it says on the banner in the background. There's even a picture of you from London 2012. It wasn't the same, but the fact that that was done in your honor, what did that mean to you? And I guess, how different did Jared Talent standing on that podium feel to the way you'd felt in London?
To be honest, it was a pretty amazing day. The Australian Olympic Committee went to a lot of effort to have a special ceremony for me to have the gold medal presented. It's very different to what you would have liked to being at the Olympics and getting a medal on the day straight after the event. You only have a few people there, but this time we were able to really think about it and plan it. So we had, invited a few hundred people to be there on the day. So it was a full ceremony. They did a few extra special things. I was presented with the Order of Australia medal as well on the same day. Yeah, a pretty amazing thing to have. It'll still never be the same as doing on the day at the Olympics, but I think it came pretty close to making up for it and having a very special moment. Unfortunately, the weather was terrible that day. It was a bit wet, but still it made up for what was a pretty horrible moment in London, missing out on getting the gold medal on the day.
How do you feel about your legacy being so wrapped up in this doping scandal? I mean, you did so much for your sport, but is it also kind of disappointing, or how do you feel?
It's unfortunate. I would rather just be known for the success I had, and there was no questions mark where I could have been or should have been. It's just a very unfortunate part that I look back and kind of makes me a little bit sad, because all those moments I could have had that could have just been rewarded on the day, just celebrated the success for what it was and not having these afterthoughts of what it should have been. So that's pretty tough. But I'm just so glad that in this day and age, it's in a lot better place. There's not really any question marks about any of the athletes competing at the minute. So it's good for all the athletes that are coming through now, but I wish it was that way back when I was coming through, but maybe that time had to happen for it to now be how it is. So it's just part of history.
I was just thinking of, like, if that had happened in my industry, if I had been involved in something like that, I would have a hard time trusting after that and not being hyper vigilant. But it sounds like you've turned it over to the authorities, and it's not your job to track. It feels like race walking is not the most well-known sport. How did you even find it in the first place? What led you to this?
Yeah, you could say it is a very niche sport. I got into it through, in Australia, we have something called Little Athletics, and it's where kids can do every event. And the walk was always the first event at the center that I went to. It was just something I really enjoyed. I enjoyed distance running as well. But I remember being at school, and there was one day I didn't make the regional team for the distance running. I wanted to find another way to get a day off school, pretty much. So I would put my hand up for the walk because I'd done it before, and went to the regional championships. I think that regional championships, I won a bronze medal, and then it just really went from there.
I have to ask, were you just a kid who, when he was walking to and from school, just walked quick anyway? Because before you get coached the technique and encouraged towards an event, were you just no hanging around for you? Was it just like, phew?
Well, if I walked to school, I would have had a long way to walk to school. So maybe that would have made me pretty fit. But nah, because I was about 30 kilometers from my high school when I started doing it. At the start, when I did start, some of the other kids at school were picking on me a little bit.
Picking on you because it's pretty niche.
Yeah, pretty niche, you know, funny thing to do. It was a bit unusual. But once I started seeing the success, no one really had a second thought about it. And they were pretty supportive. So that was cool.
Jared, for the elite level, what kind of pace are we talking about for a kilometer? How quick and fast race walkers really are?
So the world record for the men's 20K is 1 hour and 16 minutes, and it's held by a Japanese athlete, Yuki Suzuki. To walk that pace, it's about 3 minutes 49 per kilometer, which is nearly 16 kilometers an hour, or high 15 kilometers an hour. So very quick. So if you're doing a 10 kilometer run at a fun run, you'd be doing that in like 38 minutes, which is very fast.
Very.
I think if you're running a marathon and you want to run marathon in, say, 3 hours, that's about 42 minutes per 10K. So it's much faster than like a 3 hour marathon, if anyone's ever done a marathon.
A lot of people all over the world are now working out that in their head and working it out to their 5K times or whatever they've done. That's pretty. And also, you should say, because you have judges on the course checking that one part of the foot is in touch with the ground at all times, that's it, isn't it? They're quite tight loops, aren't they? It's not like on a marathon course, you might run 26 miles point to point, but you will be on loops by and large in championship racing. You're pretty close together as you go up and back and up and back and round and round.
Yeah, you sure are. So the 20K is usually raced on a 1K circuit. So it'll be just a very short loop, 500 metres out, 500 metres back. It makes it really great for the crowd, particularly if you have family and friends there coming to watch at a major event, because you'll see them all the time. I guess that's one of the regrets for the marathon runners. When they run, they get to see like large amounts of the city, but they might only see like their mum and dad once, like during the race, depending on if they can get across the city to the next point on the course. So for us, you know, particularly in the 50K, like when I was in London, Rio, Beijing, my parents on the side of the course, the family, you see them 25 times. So you get lots of cheers along the way. And one good thing about that is they usually try and make the course in a really spectacular spot. So like in London, as you said, it was on the mall in front of Buckingham Palace. So we got to go past Buckingham Palace, 25 times. In Paris next year, it's under the foot of the Eiffel Tower, so it should make some pretty good viewing.
You're listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. With us is Australia's most decorated track athlete, Jared Talent.
I think we have another photo.
Jared, this is you. You are basically in a wheelchair, and you've got a towel around you, and you look very heat fatigued. And you've got a couple of marshals helping you there. Where is this and what's going on?
So this is at the end of the 50K in Rio, so my last Olympics. It was probably the hardest race I'd ever done. I wasn't as fit as where I was in London, that's for sure. And I still had that ambition to try and win. And probably I had in my mind too much of what happened in London and wanting to win too much. And I remember probably making a pretty bad tactical error. I went to the front too early in the race. I took the lead about the 40K mark, so I still had 10 kilometers to go, which was going to be around probably 44, 45 minutes of walking to go. And while it felt good at the time, I made a big break and I got about 30 seconds in front. By the time I got to the 45K mark, I'd really started to go over the red line and started to fade. And I just remember the last probably 800 meters just trying to hold on for the silver medal was probably the worst feeling I'd ever experienced in the sport. I had no energy left at all. Everything was burning and I had two athletes behind me that were chasing pretty hard. Obviously, they wanted to try and get the silver. The gold medal was gone, but I still wanted to at least hold on for the silver medal. And yeah, just that last 2 or 3 minutes was the most pain I've probably ever experienced in my life. And as soon as I crossed the line, I just collapsed and I couldn't even move. So I just remember being on the ground and the officials were really keen to get the athletes off the ground because they didn't want a pile of athletes on the ground in front of their finish line. Yeah, other athletes are still coming through to finish. So they kind of just got me up into a wheelchair and got me out of the way, really.
It just shows, doesn't it? I mean, you've got nothing left there. And I've rarely seen a photo that stark. But you knew you had to hang in there. You knew that, like you say, everything's burning, but you need to hang in there.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, it's like every 4 years is the Olympics. So you've put in 4 years of work to get to that point. And if it comes down to only a couple of minutes where you've got to put in that extreme amount of effort, I think you're going to do it, aren't you, after 4 years of trying really hard and, you know, all the time away from family and friends and training camps. And it was definitely worth it. But I just remember as soon as I crossed the line, I was just in complete agony.
And you said that the stuff with the Russians was kind of adding extra pressure on you?
Yeah, I just thought after what happened with London, it was more so that I just thought this was my time to win. And I think I just got too consumed by that and not actually just going through the process of what I need to do on the day to actually just win. And I think I just probably wasn't giving enough credit to my other competitors. I was probably more thinking that the Russians aren't here, I can win this and it should be easier. But thinking that it would be easier, I just made an error in judgment with my tactics and went too hard too early. I still had to respect the other guys I was racing against. So, but that was, you learn, I guess. And unfortunately, that was my last Olympics. So I thought I'd be better prepared for Tokyo, but I never made it to Tokyo. So, yeah, it just happened to be how it was.
I'm not that familiar with this sport. But from what I've gathered, the difference between race walking and running is it's a lot of technique, right? It's a very, very technical kind of walking. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you haven't seen it before, it's probably quite different or unusual. It does look different. We're moving at a very fast pace. You're trying to keep contact with the ground. So, but you are walking, and to do that, you'll use your hips mostly. So you'll have a strong drive with your hips, where a runner would normally land on their forefoot, you're landing on your heel. You're trying to keep your feet very low to the ground. There's definitely a very strong arm action, probably stronger than what you would see runners. And then you just have a really long stride and quick. And the cadence of a race walker is very high. It's around 200 steps per minute. Distance runners, marathon runners are probably only doing around 150 steps per minute. Race walkers, their cadence is about similar to what a 400 meter runner would do. But obviously they're sprinting, they're only going for 45 seconds. We're keeping that cadence up for the whole three hours 30, 3 hours 40 through 50K.
You're a coach now, as you say, and you're getting ready for Paris next year and everything else. What do the athletes in your group ask you most? Like, what is the moment or the race that you tell them about? Because I know we focused a lot on what happened in London and how that went. And I know there was a World Cup race where something very similar happened to you, and you also got a gold medal retrospectively a little bit later on. But what do you tell them, or I guess, what are they asking you about your career?
Yeah, I guess they don't ask too much, actually. I probably just tell them stories to keep them entertained, and they probably get sick of hearing my stories. So they're probably not asking that many questions because they don't want to hear any more about it. I guess for me, my important part is just passing on all the knowledge and experiences I've gained so they don't have to learn as much as I did along the way.
When you were an athlete, did you know that you wanted to be or were going to be getting in coaching afterwards? Or was this kind of somebody suggested it? And what was that transition like for you? Because some athletes don't make great coaches.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point what you said. Most of the best coaches weren't good athletes. You'll rarely find a good coach who was also a great athlete. So hopefully you can prove that wrong and be a good coach as well. But yeah, I wasn't actually sure I'd coach when I retired. I'd already started working full time the last few years of my career. I wasn't being as successful as an athlete, so started full time work. Was enjoying that, but it just wasn't as fun and interesting as what coaching is. And it was just that my last coach had suggested that Athletics Australia had this athlete to coach program that they were running, and there was going to be some funding towards athletes that wanted to transfer into coaching. So I ended up getting egged on to do that. And so I applied, and I think Athletics Australia were pretty keen to have me in the program. They thought there was a lot that I could give back. So I was still a bit unsure when I started, but then I met up with these few athletes. There was a coach in my local area who was getting ready to retire from coaching. He was nearly 80, so he thought he had given enough to the sport. And he had a good squad of athletes, so he was pretty keen for me to take over. So that was a great transition. Was able to get a good group of athletes straight away and then start working with them and then try to make them progress. And then once I saw the progressions they were having, just enjoyed the time working with them. And it was pretty motivating to see the success that they were having. So I definitely started enjoying it a lot more than the last few years of my career when I had a lot of injuries towards the end of my career. Wasn't performing that well. So yeah, it was a great change and was still able to keep me in the sport.
I know that you have retired from race walking, but from time to time, like when you're going to the shops or whatever, do you dip back into those skills?
No, never.
those are locked away just for coaching.
You just take a slow stroll now.
I'm probably such a cripple these days. Even with my athletes, a couple of times I've tried to demonstrate things and I've done a little bit of race walking and I get really sore from it straight away, really sore in my hamstrings. Yeah, even now these days, like I can't sit down for too long because I get really sore on the top of my hamstrings just from all the training that I did when I was an athlete. So I try to avoid it as much as possible. Well, it would be good. It would be handy if I was, you know, in a rush and I need to
get to the front of a line.
A line or an appointment at the airport would be good, especially when you're trying to go through customs off the plane. But, I think it would cause me more pain than happiness. So.
Would you sort of do it all again in this way, Jared? What I mean by that is there was a time around and after London where I was working in sports newsrooms and people were booking interviews with you and getting you on as a guest on shows and not just on the BBC to talk about Russia, to talk about doping. And you stepped up and you were a spokesperson for this, but did it ever overshadow or eclipse what you were still trying to do as an athlete on a day-to-day basis?
I definitely wouldn't change what I did. I thought it was very important, particularly just for, not just for myself, but all the other athletes in the sport. It was incredibly unfair because things that we were doing it the right way. And it was crippling for some people that, you know, no matter what they did, they were just never going to be able to get the results that they deserved. So while it was sometimes a bit, you know, difficult, I guess, or maybe distracting, being so focused on it and probably taking away from the efforts and the training that I was doing, I still felt it was very important and something I needed to do. But it's very interesting. I'm not sure if you guys have seen, there's a Netflix documentary at the minute about an Italian race walker. It's about Alex Schwarzer. He was the 50K athlete that beat me in Beijing. And then he was banned before the London Olympics and tried to make a comeback for the Rio Olympics. It was banned again. And there's Netflix have made a documentary on him. And they've showed a little bit in the documentary about me speaking out and calling him out on being a cheat. And then since that documentary has been aired, I've been getting all these messages on Instagram from angry Italians telling me how much of a bad person I am. So, but yeah, I still wouldn't change the fact, even if I get abuse from certain people, I still would want to speak out. And I think it's very important, not just for myself, but all the other athletes that did the right thing.
I'm wondering, it took so many years for it to come into your hands. Where is the gold medal now from the London 2012 Olympics?
It's actually at my parents' house, so over in Ballarat. So about 700Ks from where I live. They've got all my Olympic medals.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, I had an event or something over there and I took them over there, but I forgot to bring them home. So, yeah, I'll get them back at some point. But, yeah, mum and dad, pretty proud of them, I guess, at this stage. So, yeah, they've got a home probably in a special spot. So, but they're all together, all the four Olympic medals, which is cool.
Thank you so much. We'll be looking forward to seeing your athletes compete. And we're very grateful for the time that you gave us today.
No problem. Thank you. Thanks for having me. See ya.
What a strange position to be in, that you're helping to change your sport for the better, but then that becomes your legacy rather than all of the effort you made performing the actual sport.
Yeah, and that was 100% what it was like, because this was a continuing story. Before World Athletics actually did something about it at the end of 2015, Jared and a few others were the voices. And he wouldn't have changed anything, but he became this spokesperson when really it should have been his efforts and his talent, and what an aptly named guest as well. It should have been those things, but just got on with it, which is so admirable. And if he hadn't have spoken up, I don't know. Would we have had the situation that we had? Would he have eventually got his medal or not? I don't know. And we'll never know that.
He made a good point that a lot of the best athletes don't make a lot of the best coaches. And I'm so thrilled to see that he's coaching, he's staying in the sport, because you know, we need to see more of that. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't know about other, you know, on the able body side, but I don't think there are enough Paralympic athletes turned coaches.
Are most of the coaches in general able-bodied?
I would certainly say, at least in our sport of para-athletics, there's very few.
We've talked to a few different, we've talked to quite a few different athletes, but specifically about the transition to life after your athletic career. I wonder how coaching fits into that. Is it holding on to a world that, is it harder to transition for some people into that role within the same world?
I'm sure it is. And he mentioned he had a different job after being an athlete, and he didn't find that as rewarding as staying in the sport and being a coach. I know people have asked me all the time, and you know what my response is?
I'm too young to think about things like that.
We might end up having to cut this out, Joel, our producer. No, my response is, I don't think I have the patience, and I don't think I could deal with the kind of rubbish that you hear from, like, I just don't think I have what it takes in terms of, like, I can't tell you, even from other athletes, like the excuses that I hear in terms of being late or why they're injured or this or that. And I'm like, I don't think as a coach I'd be able to, like, have the kind of grace and understanding to be like, yeah, I get that. I just don't think I...
See, I see this movie unfolding right here. You know, you're done with the sport. You're not pulling me back in. And some kid comes and finds you and is like, please coach me, and tricks you into it. It'll be a summer blockbuster. People are going to love it. Feel good movie of the year.
I don't know. I'm literally, when I hear an excuse or something, and maybe I think I know why a lot of the best athletes don't make for good coaches. He mentioned that. You think about MJ, you think about some of the, but because you know that what you demand of yourselves is not necessarily what everybody else is going to be able to demand of themselves as an athlete. And I think as a coach, that can be very frustrating.
Because I would say it's, in my experience, in teaching improv, comedy, musical theater, oh boy, what a nerd. I've had to remind myself, like, they can't necessarily do what I can do. And I'll be, if I don't remind myself of that, I'll be too hard on them. Cause I'm like, come on, it's easy. You just do this thing you've done 100 million times. Oh wait, you haven't yet.
But then when you are kind of nudging somebody along and trying to help them out, and then suddenly they just sort of throw in something amazing, you go, wow, I didn't even think of that.
No, I go, wow, they did that because of me. I did that.
Credit moved over to you. Yes.
I created this.
Yeah, I don't think any of us have got a coaching career. I'll just have to leave that there. I just think
no.
Need to step away.
Well, that's it from me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. And join us next time for more of this.
And unbeknownst to me, there had been death threats. And as fun as it was, all the amazing things I was exposed to during the Olympics and right after, that was a really hard transitional time in my life.
U.S. swimmer Carrie Bates on why winning 3 Olympic gold medals wasn't the biggest challenge or achievement of her life. Next time on The Podium.
A black sports star the world ignored.
She was the Michael Jordan of women's basketball.
Someone who played 2 sports at the highest level.
Possibly the best female athlete in the country.
A champion at both tennis and basketball at a time of racial segregation in the United States.
She was dealing with a more difficult era.
It's not an accident. People weren't paying enough attention to her.
Untold Legends, the podcast from the BBC World Service and BBC Sounds, tells the story of Aura Washington, the queen of 2 courts, who never got the opportunities and recognition she deserved.
This is nothing short of a hidden figure story.
It's about time the world knows her name. You can download and listen to all episodes of Aura's Story now. Just search for Untold Legends wherever you found this podcast.